The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And as always, I am your host, Soraya, here on Where Did the Road Go? And tonight, we have, what we've determined is going to be part one of a two-part interview with Mr. Chris O'Brien. Are you with us, Chris?
I'm here.
All right. And you've written quite a few interesting books, and your latest is called Stalking the Herd, which focuses on cattle mutilations, and it's kind of an epic of a book. And you've been investigating this stuff for, about 20 years?
Yeah.
And you have five books or four?
Well, I've written six. Five have been published.
Okay. Oh, okay. And do you want to tell people a little bit about your background?
Well, I've always had an interest in, the paranormal, fringe subjects, if you will. I had a real progressive mom growing up who spent some time back east and, in Asia, and my grandfather also. And she was very into, real forward-thinking things. She was into grafting fruit trees together. I grew up with an apple tree that had five different kinds of apples. She was an organic gardener. Just really, really talented. She was a dowser and did pendulum divination and all sorts of stuff. So I was surrounded by, these progressive subjects from a very early age. So, it wasn't something that was frowned upon around the house. And I did have an interesting experience when I was 7 years old. It really, really kind of jump-started my interest in aliens, potentially, unidentified object reports. The guy that built the house that we moved into in 1970 was best friends with Roger Patterson and talked to me quite a bit about, Roger Patterson, Bob Gimlin, and John Green and some of the early, Bigfoot hunters. And my grandfather was aware of the 1920s event at Mount St. Helens, where the miners were attacked by Bigfoot because one of the miners shot one, and then that night they were accosted by a whole group of them. And, I read all these books when I was very young. Everything from, Frank Edwards, Raymond Fowler, of course, John Keel later on, Jacques Vallée. And I moved to New York City out of high school. I grew up in Washington State. And I quickly learned that you're not going to make a lot of friends and influence people by talking about these subjects. So I was pretty closeted about it. I didn't really, my closest friends knew of my interests and stuff. And they were okay about it. But, when you're hanging out, at an after-hours club down in Manhattan at 4 in the morning, UFOs and aliens or, any of those types of subjects are the last thing you're going to be talking about. So, plus, heck, you live in the center of Manhattan. It's hard enough just to see the sky, let alone see anything flying around in it. So,
true.
I did have my first real bona fide UFO sighting in, it would have been 79 up in New Paltz, New York. A group of us went to a Gentle Giant concert, and after the show, we were hanging out in the football field and saw a group of what appeared to be very high in the sky, brilliant points of light. At first, the only reason why I noticed them is because I caught one of them moving, and as soon as I looked at it, it stopped moving, and so I stared at it for a while, and I saw that they were kind of milling around, and we did a little experiment with it and kind of had some sort of semblance of an interactive experience, and then we got bored and went to a party. So that's pretty much the extent of my interest and involvement up to I moved to Colorado in 1989. It just so happened to be the birthplace of the publicized cattle mutilation phenomenon, the first real major case that gained international attention happened in September 67 on a ranch that was, only about 40 miles from me where I lived in Colorado. And the Snippy the Horse case, of course, so many people are aware of it, and it's kind of gone down in the annals of the strange as being the first real publicized unexplained livestock death. And when I got there, I did ask a few of the old timers around there about it and about the UFO sightings. There were hundreds and hundreds of UFO sightings the end of the 60s into about 1970, and then a big wave of mutilation cases in the mid 70s. And you know, I just quickly realized that, you know, I was a new guy around there. And again, I wasn't going to make very much headway socially if I professed, you know, more than a passing interest in these subjects. And it wasn't until November 92, the little town I lived in at the time only had about 200 people. I was a gigging musician for many years. And on that weekend in November of 92, there was an amazing UFO sighting of two large 100-foot ovals that came down out of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, flew out into the valley, and were seen by quite a number of people in the town. And unfortunately, I wasn't around. I missed it. I heard, you know, kind of rumors of it, but I didn't really pay much attention. And then I had a New Year's Eve party, you know, a month or so later. And at one point, everywhere I went in the party, there were little knots of people sitting there talking about this sighting. So I you know, I was at the time writing articles for my little paper, the town paper, and I went ahead and started, you know, just kind of checking into their stories and cross-referencing their accounts. And then somebody chimed in, oh, that was the same night there was a cattle mutilation down in Costilla County, which is a couple of counties south of me. And so that really kind of got my juices going, and I thought, man, I'm going to come up with a tongue-in-cheek, kind of cynical, cool article and, you know, poke fun at some of the hippie types that lived in the town I lived in. And maybe these guys were, you know, still had stashes of mushrooms in their freezers or something. And, you know, I was going to put a cynical New York spin on it. And I had 2 weeks before I had to turn my article in. And so I really dove in and started researching the history of the area. And just within days, I knew that it was a complete treasure trove of stories, legends, documented reports, databases, amazing accounts, A to Z in the paranormal. Pretty much anything that you can imagine has been reported in the San Luis Valley, which is the largest alpine valley in the world. It's completely, you know, ringed and surrounded by the Rocky Mountains. It's nestled in kind of on the spine of North America, and it's a sacred site to Native Americans. There's amazing, you know, kind of fairly impressive geophysical anomalies there. There's a tradition of sacredness. It's the only area in North America that three regional groups of Indians overlap. Yeah. It has some of the more enigmatic sacred sites in the Four Corners area are up there, including the Sacred Mountain of the East, Blanca Peak, which, as I found out later, had sightings going all the way back to the 1770s. So, you know, within this 2 weeks, I managed to locate, you know, some of the top experts in the cattle mutilation phenomenon: Linda Moulton Howe, Tom Adams, David Perkins. You know, I spoke with local sheriffs who were involved in the 70s, investigating hundreds of cases. And Dr. Lynn Weldon, the head of the sociology department at Adams State College. And my little 500-word article blossomed into almost a 2,000-word article. And it was the first of a series of articles that I did every month. And I just was inundated with interest from all around the world, and within 2 months I was on national TV. So I started a snowball down the hill that even if I wanted to stop it, I don't think I could.
Okay, and the you've written 3 books on the San Luis Valley, right?
Correct.
Okay, and one on the trickster phenomena?
Correct.
And of course this latest one on the mutilations.
Right.
Now in the latest book here, you start out talking about how cattle is related to the human race throughout our history.
Right. Yeah, it's really important, I think.
And why do you feel that's important to the mutilation, the mystery?
Well, you know, for thousands of years, we worshipped and held very sacred bulls and cows. In India, we still do today. Humans revere the sacred white Brahma cattle of India. And, you know, if you trace back the, you know, the sacredness that we've held cattle in high, very high regard for thousands of years, if you trace it back, you'll find that there's an interesting spiritual relationship, symbiotic relationship with cattle and humans. I found out a very surprising fact, just to give you an idea. First of all these cattle that we see around today, 1.37 billion cattle, are recent hybrids. You know, in the last 10,500 years, we've been able to take 80 animals in the first herd of domesticated aurochs, which were actually a huge wild beast, you know, 10 foot at the shoulder, 2,500, even possibly 3,000 pounds. These things were just ferocious wild animals. And we were able to contain, I say we, it was a bunch of herdsmen or, you know, proto-cowboys, ranchers in northern Iran, were able to contain a herd of 80 animals. And from those 80 animals, we have created 940 some odd breeds of cattle and 1.3 plus billion head of cattle on the planet. So that's where it all started. And then it's interesting to kind of trace the development of belief systems around bulls and cows, and how the bull worship, which is kind of a solar aspect of religious belief, goes to the West. And today, of course, you have the, you know, the fighting bulls in Spain and bullfighting, and then if you go to the East, you see more of a cow aspect or a lunar aspect. Of course, I'm giving a Cliff Notes sort of general version here.
Oh, yeah.
It obviously becomes way more complicated, especially when you go south into Egypt, where bulls and cows were very important and worshipped pretty much equally. The whole Minoan civilization, which pretty much you can tie into the Greeks and later the Romans, that was totally based on cattle worship. You go down into East Africa with the newer Maasai and Dinka cultures, they still to this day, cattle are their lives, you know, that's their form of money even. So there are sacred traditions, and cattle have been held in high esteem and been treated ceremoniously for thousands of years. And now in the modern age, we have a very unceremonious relationship with cattle.
Yeah.
And some of these feedlots and rendering operations we can render up to 400 animals an hour, which is done pretty much by hand. And, you know, that's just one feedlot. And I think it's interesting that if you look at these big feedlots and these rendering operations that exist today, you know, that's a fairly recent development in the rendering of beef protein and these super industrial big agro operations tend to exist now, where we had the highest rates of incidence back in the 70s when cattle mutilations were one of the biggest news stories of the decade. Thousands and thousands of animals were discovered and by ranchers and law enforcement who claimed that they had been, you know, unnaturally killed somehow and disfigured, taking away the soft tissue organs. Usually the tongue is gone from deep within the esophagus. The mandible flesh on the jaw is neatly and cleanly excised. Reproductive organs are gone. If it's a cow, the mammary glands are bagged. The udders are gone. Oftentimes the rear end is taken out in a, you know, like a plug. Sometimes an eye, sometimes an ear, sometimes a patch of hide is expertly cut off. And there's no real way to explain the lack of tracks of physical evidence at the site. There's rarely any sort of crime scene evidence, although that's not always the case. And this became a real law enforcement puzzle, especially in the mid-70s. And there were a handful of investigators who were running around documenting these cases, working with law enforcement, working with newspapers, editors in hard-hit locations. And And many of them created databases that have never been brought together before. They've all been kind of stovepipe side by side. And my book is the first time that all this data has been brought together, you know, in one book. So I think it's an important work. I think it has a lot of information that puts the whole mystery into a cultural context in terms of the before mentioned history that we have with cattle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it also brings up some very, very serious health issues and environmental concerns that we should have in regards to cattle and using cattle as a source of protein.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about the whole cattle mutilation epidemic is that they're so, you know, you went over the basic idea of what a cattle mutilation is, but some of them are so different, but yet have similar characteristics. It just becomes utterly puzzling after a while.
Yeah. Yeah. There is quite a bit of consistency, you know, but as soon as you think you've found a pattern and you keep your mouth shut, it'll supply the mystery of the phenomenon will supply enough data to get you all excited. And invariably, when you open your mouth and tell anybody about it, that's when it shifts to the exact opposite.
So it has a very
which is the trickster element.
And reading through these different cases, they're really bizarre in some cases, and there are some cases where they're likely just misidentified predator action as well.
Yeah. Usually when the media gets involved, let's say regional or national media coverage erupts around an outbreak of cases, generally that doesn't happen with just a single or a sporadic case, but when there's a number of counties and ranches and law enforcement agencies and county officials that are reporting these cases, then the media invariably gets involved. It becomes a news story. And then you have a lot of people that are running around, kind of keeping their eye out for dead cows. And when they see one, they're not veterinary pathologists. They don't have the training to really ascertain, tantogenesis, the cause of death, or what could have been responsible for the disfigurement. And oftentimes, the soft tissue organs are the first organs that scavengers will go after to get into the viscera and the body cavity. And it's only if you've been trained to really, analyze these cases. And I'm an amateur. I'll be the first to admit that. But, I do have enough. I've been given enough, pointers, and I've done enough research and talked with a number of vets and veterinary pathologists and law enforcement. And so I've been sort of trained to know what to look for. But the average person doesn't have that training, and to them it looks like a strange mutilated animal that's drained of blood, that's maybe been dropped from a great height, has laser cuts is something that you hear all the time, or cookie cutter incisions, that's another buzz term, it's totally drained of fluids, and generally these are just the descriptions are the product of ignorance and not knowing what they're looking at. And when the media gets involved and starts, announcing that these things are happening, then that has the unfortunate effect of going ahead and creating cases that may be just unusual looking scavenger action that are being reported as mutilations. And you do have a bit of hysteria that breaks out in these areas, these regions and ranching communities where these cases are occurring, the real cases are occurring. So it makes it really doubly difficult for investigators to target their resources, target their time expenditures and be able to be as efficient as possible instead of, concentrating on the important cases that are extra mundane. All these other reports have a tendency of watering down, investigators' efforts and keeps us running around and not being able to really focus our attention properly. I covered an area of over 10,000 square miles. I put 300,000 miles on my truck in 6 years. Wow. So, we're talking an amazing amount of country to cover. I lived 60 miles from near a stoplight. It took me 120 miles round trip just to go to a movie, go to a doctor, hospital, go to a large hardware store, a Walmart, that was all 60 miles away, although I could see the town from my house. It took me an hour to get there. So, you know, this is a very remote part of the country. And in a lot of the areas where these cases are reported are in remote areas of the country. Not all these cases are reported, you know, in middle of BF nowhere. But there are some cases that have occurred right in town, for instance, in Taos and Las Vegas and other places. There was a case that happened right within sight of the door leading underground, the Cheyenne Mountain NORAD facility. Then there was another case a few months later. It was right around the north side of Cheyenne Mountain and some of the most secure, you know, military space on the planet.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are cases that have occurred in areas that are extremely well monitored. We had over 80 cases in the Malmstrom missile fields, for instance, around Malmstrom Air Force Base up in, you know, southeastern Montana and the missile fields in north. Eastern Colorado, southwestern Nebraska. There's a big missile field around there. There's missile fields around Offutt Air Force Base, Fort Sill. You know, pretty much these cases tend to occur fairly near military installations and bases, which I find is an interesting kind of potential correlation.
Yeah.
It is a very complex subject. It's not something that you can cover in a simple 200-page book that's, you know, got space and a half spacing. This is a 500,000 page manuscript, and I literally pulled out 200 pages, which will go into an analytical book that'll be a follow-up to this one.
And how far back do you trace through some of the history of possible mutilations prior to the most famous modern case?
Right. Yeah. The earliest case that I can find that's actually documented where something was written down, descriptions were given, come from the records of King James I of England, which these cases occurred in early 1606. Hundreds of sheep were being reported mutilated in a strange condition. And the last line of the of the entry in the court record is very interesting. It's of these things, sundry conjectures, but most agree it tendeth toward fireworks. So you go kind of scratch your head and try to figure that one out.
Yeah. And but you cover a few out of the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah, early 1800s as well in Ireland. Right. Yeah, there were some late 1800s cases. There were cases around the turn of the century, 1902, 1905, 1920 in Australia. We've had cases reported in the Midwest. There were probably cases in the 30s and 40s in Missouri, Texas. I have a pretty well described elk mutilation case that was in 1949, some hogs in the 30s in Missouri. So, yeah, these cases, they have occurred, but at the time, they didn't really strike the create a meme like the Snippy case did. The Snippy case really put this whole mystery on the map. I mean, reporters as far away as China were, you know, contacting the ranching family. And, there were a bunch of cases in the mid to late 60s in Pennsylvania that John Keel and Ivan T. Sanderson investigated. There were cases in the early 70s. But what most people who have at least some knowledge of this whole thing, most often I hear people say, oh, well, it's aliens. And that's because for the past 30, 35 years, Linda Howe and other investigators have sort of put blinders on and have really, really cherry-picked the cases to support their conclusion that ETs are here gathering genetic material for hybridization programs and that sort of thing. And you know, and somebody comes to me and says that, I say, well, wouldn't it be easier just to pick the lock in a rendering plant? You'll have as much genetic material as you could possibly ever want.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense than going around out in the fields. And I say, well, why would the government, leave cows in the middle of the field? And it's because my stock answer is, well, if they took the cows, it would be larceny. It would be grand larceny in some cases. And the animal would be gone, and there'd be a stolen head of livestock report. And that's a pretty serious crime in the West, for instance. To leave it there, you have plausible deniability. And I often find that the stranger the case, the more bizarre some of the the wounds, some of the circumstantial evidence around the animal. If it's highly bizarre, the rancher is much less likely to report it. It's cases where they see military-style helicopters, or they see what they think are some sort of occultist hooded figures. These are the types of cases that seem to, you know, kind of tick off the ranchers, and they tend to, you know, are more apt to report those. So it's in many ways, it's a self-nullifying mystery. You have the plausible deniability of the same parts of basically that are targeted by scavengers. Oftentimes, you know, predominantly are the parts that seem to be excised in the real cases. And so, you know, the debunkers and skeptics say, oh, every cattle mutilation case is misidentified scavenger action. And I think, you know, you've read most of the book, and I think you would agree with the statement that there are so many cases that we have proven, that science has proven, law enforcement has proven, without any shadow of a doubt, that were perpetrated by some sort of intelligence with extreme prejudice and with a lot of talent. Some of these cases are extremely difficult to explain away. And there is a body of scientific evidence that backs this up. Now, the Linda Howes and the people who are into this whole ET angle, which you can't factor that out. I'm not saying that couldn't possibly be an explanation, but I think it's the least likely explanation in my view. And if there are cases of this type, they're few and far between compared to the mass, you know, the vast majority of cases, which I think are done by human groups. You know, the first thing I do when I go on a case is I look to see if there's hair follicles that have been cut in a straight line. It doesn't matter what kind of insect, bird, predator, scavenger you are. You're not going to cut hair like with a sharp knife.
Right.
And if there's cut hair follicles, to me, that's an indication that somebody did that to that animal, or something with intelligence and with tools did that to the animal.
Well, why don't you tell people a little bit about the Snippy case? Now, first of all, the horse actually wasn't called Snippy. That was the father of the horse, right?
Yeah, the sire of the filly was named Snippy, and the press, you know, kind of got the names mixed up, and the owners never corrected them because it was, you know, kind of an appropriate name for a horse that ended up in the condition that it was found in. On September 7th, Snippy and several other horses were out in the San Luis Valley on the King Ranch. They, you know, the next morning, Snippy didn't come in for feed and water. So they went out looking for him, and the ranch owner found the horse a quarter mile away from the ranch house in a kind of a damp meadow. And all the tissue, the hide, the muscles, the hair, the skin, the meat, all the connective tissue was vacuum cleaned from the tip of its nose down to its shoulders. A very unusual case. We've never had one like it before or since. The horse's tracks in one version of the story ended almost 100 feet from where the animal was found. Strange kind of giant prints were found at the side. There was a piece of meat that was found on a piece of vegetation that when it was touched, it created like an acid-like burn on the hand of the horse's owner. A saucer, a flying saucer, some sort of silver object, a round silver object, was seen by the grandmother a day or two before that. She didn't have her glasses on when she was doing the dishes, so she couldn't really get a good look at it, but she definitely saw something hovering over their corral, and there's even photographs that I've dug up that show, you know, where the thing apparently sheared off the top of one of the fence corral posts. So the owner of the horse, Nellie Lewis, again, this is in September 67, based on some UFO reports that occurred around that time frame, and then later there were quite a few of them, but that and her mother's, you know, kind of, you know, without her glasses sighting, she made the statement when news got out that flying saucers had killed her horse, and that really created a huge international news story. People, you know, reporters from China, France, all over South America, they were inundated with requests for information, interviews. It hit the news, you know, services and the Associated Press and the UPI and Reuters and all that, and it really became a really celebrated story. In fact, I remember as a 10-year-old kid staying in line at Safeway in Bellevue, Washington, where I was living growing up, and seeing this like world news, you know, in National Enquirer type rag with this mm-hmm. headline and this, you know, awful looking photograph of this horse lying on the ground and people looking at it. And of course, I bugged my mom to give me a dime or 5 cents, however much it cost to buy the paper. And I devoured the story. And so I was exposed to the Snippy case, you know, within a month or so, 5 weeks maybe after it happened. So, you know, I kind of, that whole seed was planted early on. And when I moved to the San Luis Valley, I didn't move there because UFOs had been reported there. I didn't move there because Snippy, you know, had died there. I moved there because I had friends that had a house and it was a beautiful place, one of the most beautiful places I've ever lived. So, you know, all this other stuff kind of came along, got piggybacked on top of, you know, just trying to live a regular life and pay my bills and, you know, put together the most kick-ass rock and roll band I could in the area. And so, you know, it's just been off to the races ever since. You know, I've been on 70 TV shows and, you know, produced and even directed some national TV segments and field produced and helped develop programming for quite a number of shows over the years. And I do try to keep as an objective, dispassionate, unbiased view of this stuff, and I try to present the information as objectively as I possibly can. I don't factor anything out. I don't factor anything in. I'm intellectually honest. I don't put on blinders. I don't promote a particular pet theory. I really do attempt to do the analysis and allow the data to provide me with you know, the evidence to support any conclusions that I may come up with in this second book.
And you seem to be a true skeptic in that you're questioning everything. You're not...
Yeah.
And that's refreshing to read, especially in a book like this that's so packed full of information. You're not doing what Linda Howe does and push a certain idea.
Right.
And it definitely adds to the weight of the material. And the E.T. thing... It seems like, you know, we can't even prove there are extraterrestrials in the first place, much less that they're dissecting cows, and why would they do that anyway?
Right. In the percentage of cases that have, you know, unusual lights that can't, you know, won't conform to conventional aerial activity or landing traces or, you know, there's just a handful of cases where actual landed craft have been seen and one or two cases where entities have been seen. These cases are a vast minority. You know, for one of those cases, there could be 1,000 of the other, you know, really mundane, but very perplexing and high strange nonetheless, but appeared to be, you know, done with sharp implements. People don't understand, really. You gotta do your homework, and you really have to do your research, and you have to become up to speed on what happens to an animal in a particular environment during a particular time of year. What happens when it dies of, you know, whatever it might be, poison plants, bad water, old age, maybe it's taken down by, it's sick and taken down by a predator. And then what happens to it once it's dead? You really have to be up to speed to understand, you know, the natural processes that do take place out on the range. 2% of all livestock die every year. Ranchers are around dead livestock all the time. They're very familiar with what happens when a pack of coyotes comes in and overnight just totally tears a carcass up and just devours it. They know when it's strange, when their own animals won't approach it, when the other cattle seem to be afraid of the sight, for instance. When you know, there's been hundreds and hundreds of military helicopters that have been seen around these mutilation sites. And I mentioned that to Linda when I asked her to do an interview for the book. And she said, well, Chris, you know, it's just UFOs masquerading as helicopters.
Which, and of course, is possible.
It's not, yeah, of course, it's not out of the realm of possibility. But, you know, Occam's razor here.
Yeah.
You know, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and if you shoot at it and it starts smoking, and there's quite a number of cases where the helicopters have shot back, including one case where they were shooting back from at the rancher on the ground. Another team was on the ground. In 72, for instance, before the mutilations became a big news story, there weren't mutilations being reported, let's say, in Iowa. Hundreds of hogs and hundreds of dozens of cattle were being stolen. And these helicopters were associated, these mystery helicopters were associated with these rustling activity. And the vigilante patrols were being formed and helicopters were being fired on. And you know, it turned into a real kind of a nightmare for the utility companies with their, you know, helicopters checking the power lines, or National Guard helicopters. They had to fly at extra high altitudes. And there was a bit of, you know, kind of a vigilante sort of hysteria going on. And you know, there was some concern that, you know, conventional helicopter flights might inadvertently get caught up in this. So I find it very interesting that, you know, other investigators who are more attached to a high strain sort of off-planet explanation, they don't mention the cases where animals have been found killed with firearms, you know, shot and then mutilated. They don't mention the cases where animals appear to have been, you know, mutilated with sharp implements that don't have this, you know, kind of pop culture, you know, sort of cliche of laser cuts and cookie cutter incisions. And, you know, those types of cases are pretty rare. And even cases that have been scavenged, once the animal bloats, the area that's been cut or torn dries out. And then when the animal shrinks back down, those areas tend to become hard and dark and have a glistening sort of smooth kind of shiny appearance. And it looks burnt to someone who doesn't know what they're looking at.
Right.
So a lot of these types of evidence, crime scene evidence, if you will, has been misinterpreted. And these terms have become part of the lexicon. And, I, you know, there's been a number of cases where I've gone out and the rancher said, oh, they drained this animal of blood. And, you know, if the animal died, let's say poison plants or some sort of natural attrition, and the blood pressure subsided, and then maybe it got put, you know, scavenged by birds, or maybe some smaller animals, even maggot blooms can scour the edges of what appear to be cuts. All you know, gravity has a way of pulling all the fluids down into the body cavity. The moisture wicks out of it, and it loses its moisture, becomes pretty thick and gelatinous. But all you have to do is flip that thing over, and whoosh, out come all the blood and fluids that you can't see looking down at it from, you know, from an uninformed viewpoint. All you have to do is flip it over, and you'll find plenty of goodies.
But there are cases where they have been fully drained of blood.
There have been cases, yes, there have. I've had some. But out of the 200 I've had, I've only had two, you know, that maybe three, four, that the meat appeared to be grayish colored or light pink. It didn't have the robust red color. One case, the whole calf was totally drained of fluids, and the spine was gone, the right front leg was gone. Reproductive tract was reamed out. The brain was taken out of the skull with no break into the cranium. We only found one drop of blood, and this thing was in a brand fresh, spanking new 5 inches of snow, and we found one drop of blood on the left rear hoof. So that case would be an example of a high strange case. There were strange lights seen in the area, reported by two separate witnesses, unbeknownst to one another. That was, I do consider that to be the strangest case that I personally have ever investigated. But again, for every one of those, there's 100 just, you know, much more mundane cases that could be some sort of government group monitoring the environment. There's various explanations that have been proposed over the years to explain why anybody would want to do this. And one thing that I'm pretty sure of is it's not so much the head of livestock that's important. It's where it is in the environment. It's almost like, you know, if these livestock are downwind and downstream, let's say, of where we utilize uranium, mine it, weaponize it, put it into power plants, you know, put it into missiles. If you go downwind and downstream of these areas, oftentimes you'll find high incidence areas that have high numbers of mutilation cases. And, you know, just the above ground, you know, 100 above ground nuclear tests. You know, if you look at maps of the spread of radiation through the weather systems, that correlates with areas of high incidence. Of course, then you have, you know, 3,000 plus cases in South America from 2002 to 2005. You have outbreak of cases on the Canary Islands that couldn't be explained. There's been cases in the Puerto Rico, strange cases in Australia. There have been weird horse slashing cases over the years and sheep cases for hundreds of years in England. There were mutilated seals washing up in the Orkney Islands north of England in the North Sea. Dolphins washing up with identical wounds dead on beaches in south of France. Thousands and thousands of domestic house cats that have been found. They look like they've been clipped in half by a giant pair of scissors and the back end's gone.
Yeah.
Almost every urban center in Western United States has reported these cases. Even in Brentwood, you know, in some of the most exclusive neighborhoods in California back in the early 70s, there was an outbreak of these strange half-cat deaths. So it's not only cattle. It's pigs, goats, sheep, bison, elk, deer. I even had a case of a cow that was mutilated, and right next to it was a mutilated coyote, which is the only carnivore case that I've ever had. So this is a really complicated subject. It deserves an objective, dispassionate, treatment. And we really need to look at all possibilities. We can't factor anything out or in. And we have to allow the facts and, you know, the data to lead us to any potential conclusions.
All right. We've got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Chris O'Brien.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we've been talking with Christopher O'Brien about his new book, Stalking the Herd, dealing very thoroughly with the subject of cattle mutilations. And as you just said, they're not always cattle.
No.
And that's a little odd, too, I would say.
Well, you know, when you look at it, it's not really that odd. You know, there's the old adage, you are what you eat. We have been eating cattle for so many generations that cattle hemoglobin has been used routinely in war zones to as a replacement for human hemoglobin to get injured or wounded army guys or whomever back to hospital areas, and it's a virtual genetic match to human hemoglobin. I think it's 99.9 to 9 places genetic match to human hemoglobin. Swine would be second, 99.9 to 7 places. A transfusion of swine hemoglobin would kill you. But if you're a universal donor, you could literally survive a transfusion of pure cattle hemoglobin. I think right now artificial human blood is patent pending, of course, based on cattle blood. Mm. So, you know, we do have this symbiotic kind of incestuous, connection with cattle. And it's not by accident that I think cattle are the sizable majority of cases reported over the years, probably 90+% of unexplained animal death cases are of cattle. It is a very perplexing mystery. There's a high burnout rate among people that have attempted to look into this particular mystery. There's quite a number of investigators who agreed to help me, but refused to comment publicly. They allowed me access to their data, but it's just so it's so frustrating to chase after something that's leaving thousands of pounds of physical evidence behind and not get the help and not get the credibility needed to get science, get academics, get real diagnostic criminal laboratories involved. They have ebbed and flowed their involvement over the years, mostly in the 70s into the 80s. But now it's just a buzzkill, man. You know, somebody introduces you, oh, he investigates cattle mutilations. I mean, that's the last thing you want to be introduced as. And, you know, I just roll my eyes. And, I you know, you just don't want to talk about this stuff. And it can be scary. You know, this is a frightening territory. It's not like a ghost sighting where it's, dude, did you hear that? You know, or you know, I just heard a Bigfoot smacking on a tree. I mean, that's all I think important in one sense of the word. But when you're dealing with a big burly rancher crying on your shoulder because they came down and mutilated his finest breeding cow, or took his seed bull, or you know, melted his dogs out in the pasture, like the Sherman Ranch case where they had a mutilation that occurred when the rancher and his wife were in the field, just a few hundred yards away. So there are some high strange cases, I think, that are separate from the majority of cases. I think these high strange cases may tie into our ancient practice of animal sacrifice, for instance. And I do go into that particular correlation to some degree in the book. And I think, though, as I mentioned before, there appears to be some sort of monitoring program going on. Mad cow disease may be possibly lurking in the food chain. That may be one of the motivating factors behind monitoring livestock in specific geographic regions. It gets into some pretty scary territory when you really dig into it and start bouncing off some of the data off of the trending and the patterning. It's enough to you know, freak somebody out who's not grounded and really it doesn't have the ability to compartmentalize and sort of stand outside of this this type of material. And you know, I could name a whole list of people that have dropped away from the field. One investigator committed suicide. One, Tom Adams, disappeared 15 years ago. We only know of one person that's talked to him. Peter Jordan no longer will comment. Ted Oliphant, who's a police officer in Fife, Alabama, investigated dozens and dozens of cases. He'll no longer publicly talk about it. Philip Hoyle at the Animal Pathology Field Unit has been investigating sheep mutilations since the 90s in Wales and in Western Britain. He is not involved anymore. The list goes on and on and on. And it's unfortunate that we don't get the kind of, you know, attention and respect and help that we need to get to the bottom of this. I mean, I just had a case reported 2 days ago. A bull and a bull calf were mutilated up on the Crow Indian Reservation. And in a very rare twist, the calf evidently survived. I guess it's now a steer. Wow. But it was a bull calf before the operation, let's put it that way. So I'm in hopefully going to be in touch with some of the folks investigating those cases up in Montana. We had a case last year in western Nebraska that was really freaky. The animal was found mutilated and its head was stuffed down a hole in the pasture. There have been some pretty freaky ones. We've had animals discovered in trees. They're pretty rare. But, you know, again, this is an area that doesn't get the amount of attention that it deserves.
Now, when they find them in trees and things like that, I mean, the belief is that they're being dropped. If helicopters or the government or some part of the government is involved, that would make sense. They could lift it up, drop it back down. But, like, in some cases, like you said, the farmer was out right in the field when it happened. Wouldn't they have seen something?
Yeah, or heard something. Yeah, that was very, very bizarre. And it happened up on the Skinwalker Ranch, as they call it. It's kind of a misnomer. But the Sherman Ranch, the rancher immediately, it's about 10 in the morning, he immediately called the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, who had were in the process of acquiring the ranch. And a private jet flew up, a microbiologist, a veterinary pathologist, you know, a crack team of scientists who did a on-site investigation within hours. And they were just horrified by this. We had a case down in a very interesting case that I haven't really dug completely into, but there's a number of interesting newspaper reports from South America of a giant 60,000-gallon stock watering tank, basically, you know, that would water a whole herd of cattle, that was inexplicably drained overnight. Not one drop of water found anywhere. And, you know, I think in one report it said 19 mutilated cattle were found inside the empty tank. We've had animals found 2 miles away in three pastures away from where they were last seen, through lock gates and over fence lines. One animal was found, huge bull was found inside an abandoned adobe shack, and the darn thing couldn't have even gotten in there, even if it had tried to walk in there. We've had cases where, on the Sherman Ranch again, where he goes out and he's looking for his 9 seed bulls, and they're nowhere to be found, and he kind of hears scuffling, and inside a locked horse trailer, he found the animals, and there was still dust and cobwebs on the lock that you know was used to secure the door. So you know there are a number of cases that really are high strange that there's no possible prosaic answer for, and these are the cases that I think are the least likely to be reported by the ranching community. They basically, something like this happens, it's so freaky, so oftentimes they won't even tell their own family. They'll drag it off to a bone pile, they'll bury it with a backhoe, they'll out of sight, out of mind. And for many cases that I found out about, I found out from neighbors, from friends that would hear about cases, or from law enforcement sources, and they'd tell me, and I'd just slowly start working on the rancher, and finally he would, I would call him and never ask him anything about the case. I'd just, ask him about the price of hay, what do you think about, the local high school team's basketball tournament, and, I'll talk to you later, and I'd call back up a few weeks later, and then finally they just blurt out, okay, I'll tell you, so I kind of have a weird reverse psychology that I use on these guys because, to be honest with you, this is scary stuff. These guys see dead animals all the time, and when they see something that they know is high strange, it's freaky. It really puts you in a place of fear. You worry about your family. You worry about your livelihood. And we don't have enough people that are concerned enough to help these people out in this country and other countries.
Why don't you tell people a little bit about the first case you investigated?
Oh, boy. Well, the first case that I went out to interview a rancher was probably the most important case in my process. During that initial 2 weeks when I was researching the article, I contacted the local Sawatch County Sheriff. Officially, there had been no mutilations reported in Sawatch to any of the investigative databases that I had access to. And so I went to the sheriff, and he said he'd look into it. And he said, I'm not going to promise anything. We don't have files on murders that happened back then. So much to my surprise, a couple of days later, he showed up at my house and handed me a couple of dozen photographs. And only two of the pictures had any writing on the back to indicate, whose ranch it was, dates or anything like that. And fortunately, the deputy who was the main investigator for all the cases was still around. So I was able to meet with him, and we slowly went through all the photographs and ID'd where they came from. And as it turns out, there are probably 30 or so cases in Sawatch County that had never officially made any sort of databases. So I picked out the one that was closest to me. And in January 93, I went out to the next town over in Moffat, Colorado, and visited the Sutherlands, who on June 6th, they had in 1980, they had a bull mutilated, and the night before they'd been sitting down to dinner, and this helicopter buzzed right over their house, and then they heard it. They thought it disappeared, but then they heard it start up again like 20 minutes later, and it appeared to be about a mile south of their house out in their pasture. And so they ran outside to get a look at it, and this was right after sunset, so there was still enough light to get a good look at it. And it flew directly over their house, less than 50 feet. It was a 1950s, a late 40s, early 50s, like a U-47 Bell, a Whirlybird, like you see at the beginning of the show, MASH. Mm-hmm. It was one of these antique, ancient helicopters, and it was painted this weird mustard yellow color and had no markings on it, and it flew back in the direction it originally come from. And so they thought it was really strange, but they didn't think anything of it until the next morning. They went out to check on the animals, and they found their prize seed bull mutilated in the field. Well, 13 years later, of course, I have a picture of the bull in my hand, and I called up Virginia Sutherland and arranged for an interview and went out there. And she gave me, you know, all the blow-by-blow description. I interviewed her son, and then I asked him to go out to the field, and sure enough, there was the bull still laying there. It was kind of melted into the field, and I took the skull home and ended up painting it. It's hanging on my wall. And so that, you know, the next morning, I got up and was typing up my notes, my field notes, and, you know, just sitting there in my shorts and, you know, drinking a cup of coffee, and I hear this thump, 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 thump sound, and I look out my window, and in the same exact description of helicopter, an antique 1940s, 50s, UH-47 or U-47 flew right over my house, mustard yellow colored, just a totally bizarre, tricksterish coincidence, if you will. And I'll tell you, man, I just got, I kissed the tar baby that morning, boy. It still stuck to my face. That just floored me. And I kind of had a sense right from that point on that we were dealing with something infinitely more complicated than the simple answer of aliens coming from other planets, you know, that there was something way more complicated at work here.
Or even just government interaction, because some of this stuff, as far as we know, couldn't have been done by the government.
Yeah, not in 1602.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Six, rather. Yeah, so, I mean, there is a high strange supernatural, if you were, preternatural. I have often kind of had a feeling that there's some sort of dimensional predator that as soon as that belly hits the ground, that animal's fair game for something. Maybe that's why when they slaughter kosher, when they have a Jewish ritual to slaughter animals, it's called, you know, the kosher process. They don't let the animal's belly hit the ground until it's dead and drained of blood. And there's some interesting parallels if you go around the world and look at certain ritualized behavior around the slaughtering of animals. There's over a million people in this country that slaughter animals routinely for religious purposes, mostly chickens, some sheep and goats,
right?
But and some ducks and other fowl, but. But, I mean, it's a constitutionally protected religious practice of slaughtering animals and using their blood and body parts for ritualistic purposes. And this is something that most Americans, they don't want to think about that stuff. I mean, it's like, you know, all they want to know is if I go to the store, I can buy, you know, some chopped meat that's on a piece of styrofoam wrapped in plastic. Right. I mean, I don't, out of sight, out of mind, I don't care where it comes from. I don't care how it got here. It tastes good. They keep the price down, and I haven't died from it yet. I mean, that's the basic attitude in the West. And unfortunately, if people really knew how that meat got to their supermarket, from the birth canal all the way through the raising and rendering and processing, and you know, I think a lot of people would become vegetarians very quickly. 80% of the antibiotics used in the United States go into cattle.
Yeah.
A sizable majority of growth hormones go into cattle, chickens, swine. They're being kept in these horrific, huge, mega feedlots of 100,000 plus animals in places, you know, striding around in their own filth. They have to try to get them out of that very unclean, unsanitary environment as quickly as possible. So they pump them full of grain, which they're not naturally supposed to eat. They're supposed to eat grass. So they use up to 1,700 pounds of grain to put 400 pounds of weight on them, pump them full of antibiotics to make sure that they don't get sick from walking around in their own feces and urine. And then they want the animal to grow as quickly as possible, so they pump it full of growth hormones so they can get it out of that feedlot, put it into the processing chain and send it out. The beef industry in this country is one of the most powerful forces politically in this country, and you'll never hear about them unless you're Oprah back in the late 90s when she did a show on mad cow disease and made the comment, "I'll never eat another hamburger again." She was instantly slapped with a $2 billion lawsuit.
Wow.
It took her $1 million to beat it, but, you know, $1 million is $1 million. So, you know, the beef lobby is one of those real kind of super low-key, sort of under-the-radar political forces. It's the largest single section of agriculture. Back in the 1890s, when they tried to do the Sherman Antitrust Act to break up the, you know, people think they were trying to break up Standard Oil or the railroads or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. No, they were trying to break up the beef industry, the beef packers, Cudahy, Swift, Armour. So this is an area that really gets into some kind of, it's a sticky area, and it gets into some political intrigue. I find it interesting that 70 to 80% of the ranches that were around in the 70s, when these cases were hot and heavy, are all out of business now. And I have cases where it looks like rich ranchers with lots of land have been trying to drive smaller ranchers, their neighbors, out of business, using the mutilation phenomenon as an intimidation tactic, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, Linda and other investigators aren't going to even address these cases. And I've got a case with two county sheriffs, not one, but two, publicly named a rancher as aiding and abetting and helping helicopter crews who were responsible for mutilating hundreds of animals down in southern Colorado.
Yeah. You're on WVBR FM, Ithaca. You're listening to Where'd the Road Go? We're talking to Christopher O'Brien for a little bit more here on part one of this conversation about cattle mutilations and such. Wow, the thing is, it's so mind-boggling because, you talk about that, how they're aiding these crews. And where are these crews coming from? And why would they need to be aided if they were, say, a government group? Or is the...
Well, or they could hire some guys, man.
Yeah.
Just think in 1975, how many returning Vietnam veteran helicopter pilots were back...
True.
Being put into the job market. There was a lot of helicopters flying around in those days, and a lot of people that were certified to fly them. And it doesn't take much of a stretch to think that maybe that there were some, teams that were either employed by quasi-governmental groups like the CDC or the NIH, National Institute of Health, or Centers for Disease Control. If it was concern about mad cow disease, for instance, or other groups that may or may not have had some occult leanings. There's been a number of cases over the years that have had these strange ritual occult sign left behind. I had a number of them. These are cases that most investigators will not even talk about. That and ritual blood sacrifice, just, I'm probably one of the only people on the planet that really has been digging into this whole potential angle. And there is a body of evidence, and there are cases that do have a veneer of ritual occult magic to them. And I don't care who you are, you're going to have a hard time arguing with the facts. And there's a ton of facts in my book.
Yes,
your book figures is trying to close down highways and stuff and carrying torches and bizarre stuff.
At the same time, could that be a cover for whoever's really doing it? To throw off the
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, red herring cases, I think, are a significant number of cases. It seems like real cases occur. They tend to be the highest strange cases. Then you have an outbreak of very slick human perpetrated cases in and around those initial areas. Then you have red herring cases that are spread around the region. And I think it's to keep investigators running around, not focusing on the important cases that seem to occur at the beginning of a wave.
So if they're checking, if the government's checking environmental factors, why wouldn't they just buy a cow from someone, or why would they do it this way rather than...
They do. And they rent pasture and they raise their own cattle.
So why
and other livestock.
So why would they need the mutilation cover?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of these areas that mutilations occur tend to be where patriotic militia group types hang out. And a lot of, some of the areas where you have your biggest concentration of chronic wasting disease, which is mad cow disease in deer and elk, the areas where these herds are found tend to be the herds that militia groups and patriot members tend to hunt in. So, I mean, you can look at this from several different angles here. There could be some societal and political manipulation going on as a part of the overall program. I'm not saying that is the end-all to be-all explanation, not by any stretch. But you can accomplish a lot just by simply killing and disfiguring a head of livestock and leaving it there. It sends a lot of messages, and especially in remote rural areas, ranching communities tend to be more conservative. They tend to be more well-armed, more patriotic, more prone to organize and have issues with the government. Just look at the recent Bundy Ranch fiasco. And, you know, we're not even beginning to talk about some of the scientific results. I mean, we found potassium chloride, mescaline, nicotine, mm-hmm. all sorts of barbiturates, ketamine, anticoagulants have been found when they do necropsies and do workups on mutilated cattle. So there's a lot, you know, animals that have been shot and then mutilated. Correct me if I'm wrong, but aliens don't normally go around firing 30-odd sixes.
Not that we know about.
Yeah, or injecting nicotine or mescaline into an animal.
It's... You know, then it's one of these things where you feel like you're going down the rabbit hole. The more you look into it.
Oh, yeah. No, you're down the rabbit hole, baby. you just wonder when the rabbit hole's going to end. It doesn't seem to end very quickly.
No, and also when you're talking about the environmental factors, like, for instance, you cite in 1972, there were no mutilations at all. But in 1975, there were so many cases. Why? Is there a correlation there to something that's going on?
Yeah, it's funny. There were no mutilations, but there were hundreds of animals being stolen.
Okay, that was in 72.
Yeah, and in 73, you had one of the largest UFO waves ever. And the places where there were helicopter sightings had no UFO sightings.
And there have been some cases where the helicopters have morphed into UFOs.
That's only one or two that I know of.
And I think John Keel also brings up the
I have footage of a helicopter morphing into a silver orb. It's because the sun's hitting it at the perfect angle on the round canopy, and the light bloom makes it appear like it's a silver orb going across the screen. So, you know, appearances can be deceiving.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
I have great footage of that very, very, you know, effect.
And John Keel also talked about early on some cases of like ghost planes and ghost helicopters that made no noise. And this was before we supposedly had this type of technology.
Right.
So, I mean, that could factor in somewhere because something has to explain some of these high strangeness cases somewhere along the line.
Right. The Alexander Hamilton, the 1897 Yates Center, Kansas case where the great airship lassoed his calf and drug it off. He was the justice of the peace of the county and ended up, you know, telling everybody about it. And then he resigned as a law officer. And Jerome Clark years later, you know, obviously in the 70s here, claimed, oh, he was part of a liar's club and all this. And I had found no evidence to back up Clark's assertions. In fact, I found more evidence to suggest that the case was real.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's... Again, just more down that rabbit hole. All right. So we're going to have you back in I believe, June.
Okay.
And we're going to cover the other half of all of this, getting some details on some of the years and some of the other stuff going on, and some of the other possibilities of what might actually be going on and what it might be connected to. Do you want to tell people a little bit about where can they get the books?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, Amazon's going to have it. But if you want a signed copy... I'm only signing 1,000 copies, and they're all signed and numbered. You can go to Our Strange Planet, one word, Our Strange Planet. It's a strange planet. It's Our Strange Planet.com. I also have a dedicated site, Stalking the Herd. I'll go ahead and sign it and shoot it off to you. Obviously, Barnes & Noble, any sort of you know, major bookstore in your town, obviously on Amazon, you can find it. And also listen to the Paracast. Paracast.com, TheParacast, TheParacast.com. We've been around 8 years. You know, we're a heavy-hitting, hard-question show. We try to make some of our guests with extraordinary claims squirm a little bit. And we have a lot of fun doing it. And all our shows are archived at our website at TheParacast.com.
And I'll have to say, I've only started listening in the last few months to the show, but I greatly enjoy it. You guys do an excellent job.
Thank you.
And all right, so we will have you back in June, and we'll continue discussing a little bit of this. And Maybe we'll get through the rest of the stuff I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
Because I still have a long list here.
Once you finish chapter 12, I think you're going to have a ton of questions.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Christopher.
Yeah, you're welcome, man. Thanks for having me on.
The Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation.
Cool.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here, among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand spectacle de primavera. Shut the closet door.